From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, why a state-appointed manager for Detroit faces an enormous task.
The city is structured for 2 million people, but there are not 2 million people here. We have an operationally dysfunctional city.
Plus, we talked to a Michigan filmmaker about the governor's proposal to cut the film tax incentives by 50%.
If this happens, I fear like we can say goodbye to the film industry here, at least for the kind of strength that we were hoping for pre-2010.
And a conversation with Detroit Symphony Orchestra musical director Leonard Slatkin, leading the DSO this weekend in Beethoven's Ninth.
Beethoven knew that he had to write something big and spectacular. It's as if he knew this would be his last completed symphony.
Those stories and much more for you on Stateside, but first, the news. Welcome to Stateside for this Thursday. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, as the Detroit Symphony Orchestra tops off its Beethoven Festival, we speak to the orchestra's music director, Maestro Leonard Slatkin. And as temperatures continue to remain below freezing, we talk to an instructor of the Becoming an Outdoors Woman event. It's happening this weekend in the Upper Peninsula. But first this hour, Governor Rick Snyder is meeting with reporters in downtown Detroit. He's answering questions about the report he got from a state financial review team. Nobody was particularly surprised when earlier this week that review team announced Detroit is in a state of financial emergency and its current leaders lack a plan to deal with it. Even as Mayor Dave Bing protests that, yes, he did have a plan, it's just that a host of roadblocks are keeping that plan from being put into place, most Detroiters and Detroit watchers are now resigned to the fact it's likely a matter of when and not whether Governor Snyder appoints an emergency manager for the city. My next guest is someone who is watching these developments with intense interest and intense insight. She grew up in Detroit, she's worked in Detroit, and is the former chief of communications for Mayor Dave Bing and the city of Detroit. Karen Dumas joins us now. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Cindy. How are you?
Good. Well, you wrote a piece in the Free Press, an editorial earlier this week, and stating essentially it's good news, bad news if Detroit gets an EM. How so?
Well, I think on the good side, I mean, certainly I think, first of all, the report brings some clarity to the position that at least this administration and possibly a couple in the past have been saying for a long time. I especially liked some points in the report that talked about the pushback in terms of making changes that'll have a positive financial impact. But so I think it's good that it's now coming to the forefront and that the possibility of an emergency manager will give someone the autonomy and the authority to come in and make some of these changes that have not been able to push through. On the other side, you know, certainly it is a compromise of the democratic process, and it's unfortunate that, you know, council is now being cooperative with the mayor, albeit forced, at a point now when they could have done something earlier.
In fact, you put in your piece, we could have done this by ourselves if only. If only what?
Well, I mean, if only there was an honest acknowledgement and acceptance of where the city is. The city is structured for 2 million people, but there are not 2 million people here. We have an operationally dysfunctional city. I mean, certainly in today's paper, they talked about the amount of tax dollars that have gone uncollected. We don't have a system in place. And the way that the work rules and, you know, union rules are set up right now, it's not performance-based. So when you do have to go in and you want to cut for the purpose of reducing, you know, staff or cost savings, you don't necessarily get rid of the staff that's not being the most productive.
Karen, you have worked at City Hall over the past decade. You were there under both Kwame Kilpatrick and with Dave Bing. Was the dire nature of the finances, was that apparent in 2002 or even at the start of Mayor Bing's term?
Well, oh, definitely. And then I think if you go back, you'll see that Mayor Bing said from the beginning that, you know, he inherited a financial disaster. And I actually mentioned to him the other day, I said, you know, had everybody been on the same page early on in terms of executing, a lot of these things that will or may be done under an emergency manager could have been done earlier. The mayor recognized it, but, you know, he, as mayor, can only issue directives. You know, by the time things penetrate down to a department level, you do have pushback at some point from employees. And if you don't know how to navigate a city government or government at any level, by the time you realize that something hasn't been done, it's almost too late. You also have a council, many of whom are interested in either their popularity or their reelectability. And so they do things that they think are popular with their constituents, but not necessarily in the best interest of their constituents. The conversation about Bill Isle, charging a fee, that's been rotating in discussion since 2005. Hmm. But, you know, people feared that, oh, the citizens won't like it. Okay, and maybe it's a tough pill to swallow. But there are compromises that are made on both sides. But that should have been done long ago.
So when you think of kind of the critical mass that we're at now and the sheer enormity of Detroit's troubles, and you look at its leaders, at Mayor Bing and City Council, do you think, since you were there in City Hall, were those leaders, however well-intentioned they may be, were they the wrong people for the challenge at the time?
Well, you know, I'll be honest with you. I say a lot of times it's not the people, it's the process. And I think that most elected leaders go in with the best of intentions. But when you get there and you see an antiquated process and you see an over-processed system, and one that's just not set up for progress, I think a lot of times people just kind of fall into place because they get tired of fighting. And again, like I said, especially on council, you know, they have the public in their ear constantly. They're on television. I think those things weigh into more of a different kind of presentation that's not necessarily productive or in the best interest of the city in long term.
Karen, if the shoe drops and emergency manager is appointed, it's like taking bitter, bitter medicine. Where do you think the city of Detroit will be, let's say, 5 or 10 years down the road after drinking this medicine?
Well, I think, Cindy, it's going to depend on who the emergency manager is. I mean, it's, you know, there have been conversations floating around. Nobody is exactly jumping at the opportunity. So it's going to depend on who it is. If it's somebody that comes from outside that does not have relationships and that's focused on two things, the financial stability of the city and restructuring how the city operates. You know, you've got to focus on generating revenue. So this person has to do a balancing act. Then I think that the city will be on solid ground. If they don't, then I don't think we're going to be any better off 5 years from now than we are today.
Good talking with you, Karen. I hope we can do it again.
You too, Cindy. Thank you so much.
Karen Dumas is the former chief of communications for Detroit Mayor Dave Bing. Well, here's a statistic for you to think about. The number of freshman college students from China attending Michigan State University this year is 385 times greater than it was a decade ago. That fact got Ron French wondering, is a student from China taking a Michigan kids college slot? French has a story out in Bridge Magazine today where he's a senior writer, and he joins us now. So, Ron, as you were exploring this, what did you find? Why is there such a major increase in the numbers of Chinese students at MSU?
Well, there's the logical reason, and then there's the actual question in the mind of officials at Michigan State. The fact is that there are fewer and fewer students graduating from high school in Michigan because our population is declining. So that universities are looking to fill their classes elsewhere. But why are they coming from China? The question really we are not even sure the answer to that. The university is not doing a lot of marketing in China. As far as they know, there may be some connections to research projects that are going on in China connected with Michigan State. But really, they believe it might be just that the reputation is getting out. This is a good place to study.
So you see fewer high school grads. Certainly, we know there's less state funding, and all of those foreign students coming in are paying great, big, juicy out-of-state tuition.
And that's the other thing that's really helping Michigan State and U of M in some ways. The in-state tuition for a student from Ann Arbor going to Michigan State is a little over $12,000. For an international student from China, it's $33,000. And a lot of the scholarship and grant money that's available for the in-state students is not available for that kid from China. And so they're paying more. Those kids are paying full freight. So that's a big difference, and it's making a huge difference in the budget for MSU.
And what about U of M?
U of M, the international enrollment is going up over the past decade, but what you're really seeing, the difference there, is a large increase in enrollment from other states. Sort of U of M and MSU are getting to the same point by different means. At MSU, you're seeing a large increase in international students, particularly from China. U of M, they're solving the problem of declining high school grads in Michigan by bringing in more students from Illinois and Pennsylvania and New York.
And how about other Michigan public universities? What did you find there?
Most public universities in the state still have a very high percentage of in-state students. Besides U of M and MSU, the two exceptions to that are Michigan Tech, which is an engineering school that draws students from around the country, and oddly enough, Northern Michigan, which saw its numbers declining, saw the handwriting on the wall, and began marketing itself to students in Wisconsin and Illinois, and they're having great success bringing in kids from those two states.
So a parent whose child opened up a waitlisting announcement or not admitted might connect the dots and ask that question. Are the out-of-state and foreign students taking slots away from our kids? So are they?
That's a very good question. I know it's on the minds of a lot of parents, especially this time of year when everyone's waiting for that big, fat envelope from U of M or MSU. And the short answer is, despite the way those numbers look, the answer is no. Because both at U of M and MSU, the proportion of applications from in-state students that get acceptances from those institutions is going up. Those institutions are doing whatever they can to keep their in-state enrollment up. It's just that their overall enrollment is growing to balance things out. They're bringing in more kids from either international or from other states.
So if you're driving on that campus in East Lansing and you do see large numbers, and you will, of Chinese students, it doesn't mean that some kid from Petoskey couldn't get into MSU.
No, it does not. And in honesty, you should probably thank that kid from China, because they're helping subsidize your child's studies at Michigan State.
Ron French's story is "A Student from China Taking My Kid's College Slot" appears in today's issue of Bridge, and we have a link for you on our website at michiganradio.org. Ron, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Still to come, as the Detroit Symphony Orchestra wraps up its Beethoven Festival, we speak with the orchestra's music director, Leonard Slatkin. That's coming up in 20 minutes. You're listening to Stateside here on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Yesterday, we heard from the Michigan Film Commissioner, Margaret O'Reilly, and her views on Governor Snyder's proposal to cut the state's film tax credits from $50 million to $25 million. Even as lawmakers line up on either side of this issue, some vowing to fight to maintain that $50 million, and others agreeing with the governor that the film incentive takes money away from must-have programs such as public safety, education. The filmmaking community is watching and wondering whether Michigan's film industry can stay afloat. One of those filmmakers is Michael Zervos of Northville. His company is Mother and Midwife Pictures. He's in pre-production right now for a film called Papu, to be shot here in Michigan using Michigan actors. Welcome, Michael. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
So how important, as we talk to you as a filmmaker, are these state tax credits to your process of getting a film done?
Sure. Well, the whole reason why I'm making this film is because of the incentives. I mean, I lived in L.A. for a while, and I'd probably be there still if it wasn't for the fact that these incentives allowed me to create a film, the budget of $200,000, for much, much less. And I love this state, and I would like to stay here, and I would like to be able to set a base here and to hire Michigan fellow Michigan filmmakers, actors, and crew members. And the reason why I came back here is because of the generous film incentives. So they're very important.
Under Governor Granholm.
Under Governor Granholm. Well, actually, the 40%, 42% that was removed, mm-hmm. I didn't have anything. I didn't touch that at all. When I came back from L.A., I touched it's about 30 to 35% that I'll be receiving on my film if approved. But that's the reduced amount that Governor Snyder had invoked.
Okay. So tell us, if you could have your way and get the support for state tax incentives, how does that work?
Sure. Well, it always starts with a story. You write a script and you start hiring individuals that might be able to support you, producers, individuals that are familiar with the incentive. My co-producers and my line producer have guided me through the process because this is my first time working with incentive programs.
And the process being?
The process is you'll submit – it's a very lengthy document. Mm-hmm. And compared to what there used to be with the 40-42%, they have closed some of the loopholes so that you can't really have any independent contractors. The state wants to get money. They want to make sure that they're not getting the 10% on the dollar, I think, that they were getting before some of the loopholes were closed. But what you do is you fill out a bunch of documents. You have to submit your script. You have to submit a list of Michigan residents. You have to submit a budget. And it's a very thorough process. You have to have 80% of your budget before you actually apply to the incentive program. So I had to raise approximately $160,000 before I could even apply. So after all that, the state is really interested in making sure that you have a budget, that you have a script, and then you're hiring Michigan workers.
And you have to document that.
And you have to document all of it.
And now the $160,000 mm-hmm. that you had to raise.
Sure.
How'd you do it?
Well, it was a combination of private investors and Kickstarter, actually. And Kickstarter has been a great boon to us as independent filmmakers, as video game designers, artists in general. We put our project online, and we advertised it, and we raised $50,000, I think $51,000. So it was fantastic for us, and it not only added to our money that we didn't have to pay back to our incentives. It also promoted the film because it acted as like a blog, a platform that we could send all over the world and people could donate to us and listen to my voice, my video, which mm-hmm. was on there. And if they liked it, then they donated.
We're speaking on Stateside today with filmmaker Michael Zervos of Northville. His company is Mother and Midwife Pictures. They're right now in pre-production for a feature film called Papu that Michael's hoping to shoot here in Michigan, and he's certainly hoping to take advantage of the film incentives being offered by the state. Right now, we're at a $50 million film credit cap. Governor Snyder's recent budget proposal would cut that to $25 million. If that happens, what do you see happening for producers and directors like yourself, Michael?
Well, in 2009 and 2010, we saw an incredible what Michigan filmmakers call the golden age. I use that kind of as a tongue in cheek because it was only 2 years long, but we saw thousands of jobs come in here. A lot of indirect spending. I think $80 million or $800 million of economic output. And now, because of this, Hollywood doesn't really trust Michigan anymore. The Michigan filmmakers felt like the rug was pulled out from under them. Same with Hollywood producers. And they don't want to enter a political issue where they feel like there's a lot of tumultuation going on mm-hmm. in Michigan right now and a lot of political indecisiveness. So if this happens, I fear like we can say goodbye to the film industry here, at least for the kind of strength that we were hoping for pre-2010.
Yet Governor Snyder says, yeah, the film industry is great, but mm-hmm. the incentives are not the way to do it.
Yes.
How do you answer that?
Well, I understand. I've lived in the state for my whole entire mm-hmm. life. I absolutely love the state, and I want to make sure that it succeeds. The governor, I believe the governor is wrong for a couple of different reasons. This Michigan incentive not only creates a lot of economic output, a lot of jobs, but it also creates a lot of excitement for my peers, 20 through 30 people coming out of college, wanting to make movies, and people that have been out of work for a very long time. These are individuals that that would be working in Michigan if it wasn't for the fact that that these incentives could be dissipating. So I think that the government wants it to do, of course. The 10 cents on every dollar in 2009 and 2010 mm-hmm. Wasn't good enough for them. And it closed some loopholes. This new incentive has closed some loopholes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that is the way to go. But I think I tell the governor that it needs a little bit more time. And we saw growth from 08 to 2009 and 2009 to 2010. And I asked the governor just to give us a little bit more time and show him that we can actually create a viable economic program.
Tell us a little about Pepu. I know you're in pre-production now, correct?
We are. So the film is about a child and his relationship with his grandfather. The grandfather, he's diagnosed with cancer, and he eventually tells his family the news, but he doesn't tell his grandson. And throughout this transformation his grandfather is growing through, his grandfather withers and goes through chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. His grandson misinterprets this and imagines that his grandfather is going through changes that aren't actually happening. And he copes with this process of loss in a completely different way than his family. And so this story is about imagination, is about life and death, all told through a child's perspective.
And you're planning to have how many Michigan actors and crew in your film?
Oh, boy. We have over 40 Michigan cast members, and we've actually just finished casting, and we're releasing those names on our website. And we have, I would say, 40 to 50 crew members, too. So we're hiring about 90 Michigan workers.
So the high hopes. So what's next? What are we going to watch for? You're in pre-production, which means you're doing the casting.
Sure.
Getting your money together.
Right. We are continuing to finance. We are finishing up location scouting. So we're looking all over the Metro Detroit area to find locations to shoot at our film. And pretty soon we'll start going into figuring out what kinds of shots we want, designing the set, the wardrobe, makeup, all the little odds and ends that go into filmmaking. That's what we'll be doing during pre-production starting May 1st.
Michael, do the film incentives, the state tax credits, mm-hmm. are they more helpful to small independent producers like yourself or for the big guns, the George Clooneys who produced and directed Ides of March or Disney coming in with Oz in terms of movie making in our state? You're very nimble in a way that a Disney production is not. That's a behemoth. Which benefits more?
Well, I would say that with production companies as large as Disney, they have the money to create massive films wherever they go. They can shoot it somewhere, whether it's in-state or out of the state, out of the country. They're going to make their movie regardless. Now, for an individual like me, I wouldn't have been able to make my movie if it wasn't for the incentive. So it's either a make or break for me. Disney makes its Oz film regardless. Mm-hmm. George Clooney makes his film up in the air regardless. Ides of March. And I think that it's a benefit to independent filmmakers because they just don't have a lot of money to begin with. They don't have a lot of big names that are going after their films. And everybody has to start small.
And if you talk about a percentage of Michigan workers, mm-hmm. Do you have a bigger percentage planned for your movie than a percentage that would be used, let's say, in a Real Steel or some of the big studio productions?
Well, I would have said that may have been the case pre-2010 mm-hmm. when there were still a lot of individuals that were coming out of Hollywood either in higher managerial positions or higher crew positions, what we call above-the-line positions. But now, I think that films such as possibly this Gosling movie, mm-hmm. which is casting outside of their lead roles, casting a lot of films here locally, I think that you're going to see a lot higher percentage in big budget movies than you used to. So I hope to see an increase, and I think that that's going to happen too.
Well, we are talking with Michael Zervos, filmmaker from Northville, who is in pre-production right now for a feature film called Pepu that is hoping will be shot in Michigan starting this spring, mm-hmm. and also keeping his fingers crossed that the film incentives stay at that $50 million in tax credits and not cut. So we shall see as the story evolves. Michael, thanks for talking with us today.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
All right, ladies, let's be honest. Here's a question for you. When you think of winter in Michigan, do you come up with images of curling up with a book, maybe exploring your Netflix queue with a cup of tea or maybe a glass of wine? In other words, riding out the cold weather before you go outside for summer? Well, my next guest believes that every woman listening to me right now can do so much more during a Michigan winter. She's trying to get women and their families outside, even when it's below zero. Frida Wara is an instructor of the Becoming an Outdoors Woman event. It's happening this weekend in Big Bay in the UP, and she joins us now from Marquette. Hi, Frida.
Hi,
Cynthia?
Well, it sounds like, as I read about all the things you do in becoming an outdoors woman and really in your life, you could turn the most determined winter couch potato into somebody who actually looks forward to zipping up a parka and getting outside to play no matter what the weather.
Oh, you betcha.
Well, Frieda, what happens during this Becoming an Outdoors Woman weekend? What kinds of skills are the people who are coming going to learn?
It depends. You get to choose three classes in our winter program, three classes, summer program, four classes. So classes will start Saturday morning. Everyone kind of arrives on Friday. We have a special event on Friday night. They can take, the Becoming an Outdoors Woman program, and I believe there's about 36 states that host a BOW. And it's a program that started some years back by a gal over in University of Wisconsin area, and she basically wanted one-third of the class offerings to be hunting, one-third to be fishing, and one-third to be of the silent sports. So you can take, for example, if you want to learn a little bit about ice fishing, that's there. We have wilderness first aid. Indoors, we're going to do wood burning because it's always good to just, have some indoor activities as well, but they're always related to something of the outdoors.
Okay.
We even do GPS and geocaching. I teach cross-country skiing, but because I also love to sleep out, we have a winter shelter class that's taught by Tara Glusky, and the gals Saturday morning and Saturday afternoon that take that class, if they want, they can sleep in their Quinsies that night, and that's really special.
Now, what's a Quinsy?
A Quinsy is basically an igloo. You build it instead of cutting ice, you make it out of snow, and you make big mounds of snow, and we use the word tank in the UP. Mm-hmm. Basically, you take a shovel and you kind of, continue as you mound up the snow, you continue to beat on it so it hardens up real well. And then you get the smallest girl in the group to be the snowworm, and they go in and they start digging from the inside out. And you just keep hauling the snow out, and you've got this great little shelter, and it's very warm. But the best part about it, Cynthia, mm-hmm. it's so quiet. We kind of say, why would you settle for five-star lodging when you could have a whole sky full of them? And it'll be your quietest night of sleep ever.
Frieda Wara, why is it so important to focus on women? What's behind that?
Well, sister, the secret is, if you don't get mom outside, chances are the kids are not going to get outside. And I don't want to make that a blanket statement, Cynthia, mm-hmm. but truly, many times dads just don't come with that same kind of patience. They don't put cookies in their pocket. And to get the kids outside, particularly cross-country skiing, you need to have candy. And you need to be really soft to the kids when they say they're tired or it's rugged work. Downhill skiing, heck yeah, kids will get on a chairlift anytime. But cross-country skiing, you might have to just make it a little bit of a shorter jaunt. And if dad's out there to get a workout, it's not going to be the same. But mom is out there to help these children explore. And if you open that book for children with patience and with, what moms do all the time, it will just serve them for the rest of their life.
It does seem, Frieda, that fewer people get outside. There's the lure of laptops and iPads and big screen TVs and, of course, right this time of the year, warm houses. Describe for us what you get personally from your outdoor winter activities. What are we losing by not getting outside? And it sounds like just getting outside and playing.
I think sometimes you just need to take those eyeballs out and let the wind blow through and kind of clear the cobwebs. And there's also the whole idea, especially for women. And, I'm going to talk, I'm in my late 50s, but I really think from the time I was 40 plus, I was looking for something that was going to stretch me. I needed to do something different. I needed to step out of my own little box and do something that maybe it scared me a little bit or it was a little bit foreign.
Mm.
I was just at Boyne Mountain in January, and I ziplined, and it's not like me to go upside down, 50 feet up in the air across a little gully, but doing that and the invigoration that you feel. And the other thing is, so much of our life is wrapped up in spending. Well, what you need to do is you need to spend
energy and time.
Well, the event is this weekend, the Winter Becoming an Outdoor Woman event. There is also going to be a summer one, and we have put up a link to the state DNR page with all the information on the Becoming an Outdoor Woman events that happen, thanks to the Department of Natural Resources. And we've been talking with one of the energetic instructors, Frida Wara. You're a blast. You are like a bracing run in the snow.
Well, and Cynthia, please, if you get a chance to get up above the bridge, you get to Marquette and we will always play. And in the summer BOW, I teach kayaking, but there's all kinds of great classes there, too. You can look at the whole schedule. And, you know, it's just a great time. It's kind of like girls going to camp again. You can leave your curling iron at home. You don't need to worry about the makeup. Just pack light. In the summer, we do probably need you to bring sunscreen and bug dope. But other than that, it's a piece of cake.
It sounds fun. Frida, thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Coming up next, we speak with the world-renowned musical director of the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, Leonard Slatkin. He's leading the DSO this weekend in Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. That's next on Stateside, here on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The sounds of Beethoven are ringing through Detroit's Orchestra Hall. Starting tonight and running through the weekend, the Detroit Symphony Orchestra tops off its Beethoven Festival in magnificent style with Beethoven's Symphony No. 9 in D minor. These performances are the culmination of 3 weekends' worth of Beethoven, with music director Leonard Slatkin leading the DSO through all 9 of Beethoven's symphonies. In fact, it's worth noting it's been 36 years since the DSO served up all 9 symphonies in one complete serving, if you will. Maestro Leonard Slatkin joins us now. Maestro, welcome to Stateside.
Good to talk to you.
Well, as we speak, the concerts for the Saturday and Sunday are all sold out, and there's really only a few tickets remaining for the Thursday and Friday concerts. And I got to wondering, what do you think it is about the music that was premiered in Vienna in 1824 that speaks so clearly and strongly to audiences in Detroit in 2013?
The music of Beethoven has never, ever gone out of favor or fashion with any audience. It is the music that we measure all other music by. And the Ninth Symphony in particular is that game-changing piece, very much like the same composer's Third Symphony, which moved us away from the classical structures of composers like Haydn and Mozart into a whole early Romantic feel, music of Schumann, early Brahms, etc. Well, the Ninth Symphony of Beethoven moves us away even from Beethoven's own high standards, and he brings us into a world of the symphony almost twice as long as any that had been written before. This one incorporates a great finale with chorus and 4 soloists, something that had not been done before. There are matters of structure and form that are all new. Beethoven knew that he had to write something big and spectacular. It's as if he knew this would be his last completed symphony. And it speaks particularly to humanity. It has a message. Most symphonies are just symphonies. Mm-hmm. The message is purely in the music. But because this has words, it's another matter. And these words, the ones that do resonate with everyone in the world now, have to do with creating consonance in a world of dissonance. What that means is, musically, the last movement begins with this incredible crunch of sound, something you don't really associate with music almost 200 years old. And then eventually the singer comes in and tells us, stop, let's not have this noise anymore. Why such furiousness over this? We need brotherhood. We need humanity. That's what's needed at this time. And that's what this piece is about. It's a search for 3 movements about what is life, what does it mean, And in the last moment, Beethoven's conclusion is that it must be about people living together.
And isn't that a message that we need right now?
We've needed it, well,
always,
forever.
Forever. And the fact that Beethoven wrote the Ninth when he was profoundly deaf, what does that say to you as you explore the Ninth? What does that say about the kind of man he was?
Beethoven wrote a letter to his brothers upon realizing that he would go deaf. And this was about the time of the Second Symphony, so quite a few years before the Ninth. And in it, he contemplated even suicide. But he also said, perhaps a little egotistically, that he knew he had a role to play for the future and that he had to continue. So we admire his bravery, overcoming for a musician, which must be the most horrible thought of all, losing the one sense you need. And yet Beethoven produces this incredible body of masterpiece after masterpiece. And it's possible to think that he did this because he was not encumbered by listening to the world on the outside, whether it was social, cultural, musical, whatever. He could simply create from within without dealing with whatever happened on the outside.
Maestro, is it true that when the Ninth was premiered in Vienna in 1824, that the musicians, they had another musical conductor and they were told, ignore Beethoven? Is that true?
That is exactly true. There was a man who was positioned beside Beethoven, leading the performance. Beethoven was waving his stick, and we know that at the very end, when the symphony was over, the orchestra finished, but Beethoven was still conducting. He didn't know where they were. And the mezzo-soprano soloist had to tap him on the shoulder, have him stop conducting, and turn him around so he could witness the huge ovation he was being given. It's a very sad but a very moving story.
We're speaking with Maestro Leonard Slatkin, who is wrapping up the Beethoven Festival with the Detroit Symphony Orchestra this weekend with Beethoven's Symphony No. 9 in D minor. Maestro Slatkin, you came to the DSO in that 2008-2009 season, and you have certainly seen the symphony through very challenging times, seen this city of Detroit in challenging times. You even took a salary reduction to help ease some of the financial crunch. What is it about Detroit and the DSO that brought you here and is keeping you here?
What brought me here are first and foremost the musicians of the orchestra. Second, the incredible orchestra hall. This is one of the most magnificent visual and acoustic structures in the world. And third, as I became more familiar with Detroit, I absolutely fell in love with the spirit of the people in this city. I felt that if any city can come back from adversity, and I'd been in St. Louis when it had really pretty much been written off as well, I saw a city bounce back. But here in Detroit, I saw more than that. I saw a determination to grow, to move ahead, but also to hang on to the traditions. The fact that you have people in this city who move, whether it's a Dan Gilbert with Quinken Loans, whether it's Kid Rock, whoever it happens to be, you have people who so much believe in this city and what it can be and what it should mean, that this is inspiring. It causes me to want to work even harder to make the Detroit Symphony part of, if not one of the main focuses, of the growth.
I have to share a story with you, Maestro, about Orchestra Hall, which, as you know, sat pretty ignored for many decades while the symphony orchestra played at Ford Auditorium. And when I was in high school, that's when the move became active to let's restore Orchestra Hall. And I was one of a squad of volunteers, and it was 1970 or 71, who came down and we spread sheets over every chair in order for the symphony to come play, because it was so still pretty decrepit and tired inside. But they wanted to be able to let people sit and enjoy and appreciate the acoustics. And there was such a squad of us that came out to kind of help save Orchestra Hall. And then here you are. Here we are in 2013, and you're talking about what an outstanding house it is.
It's true. That group headed by Sam Frankel did something even more astounding than what Isaac Stern did for Carnegie Hall. They made sure that Orchestra Hall not only would be preserved, but it would be restored to a point where its magnificence, its splendor, its acoustics, everything would be a destination. And I know that every soloist that comes to play with us, every conductor, and everybody who comes to join the orchestra, they come away from here going, we have to return. We have to be part of this. They love the orchestra for the players. Hopefully they love a conductor or two, and not so often, but once in a while it's a nice idea. But mostly they come away from the feeling of totality of music making. They're able to do what they want to do on that stage. And you can't say that in a lot of places.
How, based on your huge experience conducting orchestras around the world, how would you describe for us the sound or the personality of the Detroit Symphony Orchestra?
Well, fortunately, I'm hearing more and more from people who hear us for the first time, and we've had many first-timers come over the last couple of weeks. They come back, and the first thing they go is, what an orchestra, that string section, what a sound. So I think that, first of all, what differentiates an orchestra from any other musical institution are its strings. If we were just winds and percussion, we're a band.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing wrong with being a band. There are great bands in the world. But being an orchestra requires that the string section be paramount. They play in virtually every piece we do. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that we have a brilliant set of wind and percussion soloists, people who could stand in front of the orchestra as well as being part of the orchestral fabric. Not only do they do such a great job as soloists, but they know how to play into the fabric of the string sound itself. So there's an organic sound to this orchestra. I wouldn't say we're flashy in the way some American orchestras are. We can do that when we need to.
Mm-hmm.
But more important to us is this feeling of a unified, rich sonority that we can produce due to Orchestra Hall.
You wrote a book, Conducting Business, Unveiling the Mystery Behind the Maestro, which kind of draws the curtains a little on what it is like to be a conductor. And you were actually a composition major, weren't you?
I was for a while. I've bounced around from one thing to the other. I do think anybody who's in music, in particular conductors, need to take some time to write music. Because in order to understand the ease or the struggle that composers have gone through to create what we're ultimately going to perform, it's helpful for us to understand that process. Of course, everybody does it in a different way. And I still do some writing occasionally. I'm married to a composer, so I know what that creativity part is about. But for us, we're mostly recreators. We're doing what somebody else has written. We have to decide what's the spirit of that music, how can we use our own creative parts, though, to perhaps get under the skin of what the composer was writing. What were they thinking? What were they feeling? Very important.
Can I take you back to your 1966 debut with the New York Youth Symphony? What were you, about 22?
23.
23. What do you remember about stepping up there for that first time for your debut? How did that feel?
Well, it was in Carnegie Hall, not exactly the smallest place to make a debut.
No.
And all the years prior where I'd been going to concerts, sitting in the hall and watching all those incredible musicians going in and out, I thought, well, this is a lovely hall. It's a pleasure. It's an honor to listen to music. And then when I saw it for the first time from the stage, standing on it, I realized, I didn't realize this place seats about 10,000 people. It looked so big and so cavernous. And all of a sudden, the shadow of all those giants who'd been on the stage became overwhelming. What was I doing there? What did I belong? Of course, then people reminded me about
other folks who perhaps were not so gigantic, and it came into balance. By the time I finished the concert, I felt very comfortable in that hall, but it was a little disconcerting. I didn't get nervous. I just got anxious.
It was probably quite the reality check.
Oh, very much so, and it's that way every time. I don't really get what people do call nervous. My dad told me when I was young, he said, you know, if you get nervous, it's because you're not prepared. You don't know what you're doing, in which case you shouldn't be out there anywhere. So the idea is that you go into performance confident of what you're going to do, and the only feeling you should have is of anticipation and excitement.
As you conduct works by different composers, and I know we've been talking about Beethoven now because of the festival, do you feel yourself kind of locking in, kind of, I hate to use the term because it comes from Star Trek, but kind of like a mind meld with the composer?
To some degree, that's the idea, that we contact the spirit of the composer. I mean, literally, we see this from the notes on the page. We don't have words. We have notes, we have circles, and we have lines. That's about it. And those are supposed to tell us what the composer was thinking of, what the intention was. And we must get into the mind of the composer in order to really properly conduct. So the times when I rehearse or when I'm performing, it's more about simply saying, if this composer was alive now, what would they feel about this music? How would it relate to today's audience? How do we keep the spirit of music written 200 years ago, but have it relate to our audience today? For example, with Beethoven, here we are playing music set of not quite or sometimes 200 years old. The music is wonderful. It's great. But should we play it as it was played 200 years ago? Mm-hmm. We can. We can't listen to it that way. Nobody can. Ears that have heard Bach, Bartok, Stravinsky, Debussy, Andrew Lloyd Webber, Jay-Z, whoever it happens to be, that influences how we listen to any other piece of music. So we listen to it with the sensibility of people who've heard music after the time of Beethoven and others. But at the same time, to not understand the spirit, what the composer intended, what they meant, that's detrimental. You must do that first and foremost. You have to answer the question, why did the composer make such and such decision in every bar?
And take it from there. And if you and I were somehow able to talk with each other, let's say 100 years from now, do you believe Beethoven will still be speaking as strongly to audiences then as he did in 1824 and he's doing in 2013?
Leonard Bernstein was asked a question by a student. The question was, who is the greatest living composer? And without hesitation, Bernstein said, Beethoven. That means that his music still has this life and this vitality. The great composers will always be with us. We're not exactly sure 100 years from now what form the listening experience will take. Who could have believed today you could turn on your computer and hear music from all over the world, you could listen to anything you wanted to, so forth and so on. But whatever it is, Beethoven will still be there. And for many, many musicians, he will be at the top of the list.
Maestro Leonard Slatkin, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
My pleasure.
The Detroit Symphony Orchestra's Beethoven Festival wraps up tonight through Sunday with Beethoven's Ninth Symphony in D minor. And as Beethoven sees us out, we want to extend an invitation that we want to hear from you. Is there a story that you want covered? Maybe someone you think we have just got to talk to? Let us know. You can find us at michiganradio.org. Click on the link that says Stateside. And we're on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And on Twitter, at Stateside Radio. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. We were engineered today by Bob Scahn. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Maya Friedman, Emily Fox, and Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.